You're listening to The Rhythm of Rebellion by Taina Asili. For the last decade, Brooklyn-based Sunny Singh has brought his fiery trumpet and vocals to audiences around the world. Sunny's first musical outlet as a child of immigrant parents in North Carolina was singing Sikh devotional music, later exploring many other musical genres. In 2003, Sunny co-founded the political rock band Outer National and recorded an album produced by Tom Morello. Since 2008, his vocals and trumpet have become central to the sound and raw energy of the renowned Bhangra brass band Red Bharat. Sunny's 2022 debut album, produced by Will Dog Abers of Ozil Motley, is entitled Chardi Kala, the Sikh concept of revolutionary optimism. Chardi Kala is a return to Sunny's Punjabi and Sikh roots, but with the lens he's developed over the course of his life as a touring musician, educator, and activist. Sunny and I first came together when we were working on a show at Carnegie Hall with Toshi Regan. Since that time, we've had the opportunity to work together in various ways. Sunny recorded on my song Abolition, released in 2022, and we are now working together in the classical music fusion collective, Many Messiahs. I'm so excited to have him on the show today to tell us more about his history, his new album, and how he sees his work woven into movements for social change. Hi, Sunny. Thank you so much for joining The Rhythm of Rebellion. I'm so excited to have you on.
Thank you for having me. It's very exciting.
So I have been wanting to have this conversation with you for a while. I know you through a collaboration with Toshi Regan was the first place that we connected. I have seen Red Bharat. I'm a big fan. I have loved getting to know your solo project music. Then, of course, we're now working together in Many Messiahs, and I'm excited to see how that unfolds. But I don't think we've had a time to really sit down and talk about your music and sort of the history, you know, of how you have landed where you've landed today. And in reading your bio, I've noticed a lot of points that we connect in our journey, from like growing up in homes where maybe traditional music was played and being inspired there and finding other types of music as forms of expression and so on and so forth. And so I just love getting to know that story. And I wanted to start our conversation really from the beginning. So you describe Chardi Kala as a return to your Punjabi and Sikh roots, but with the lens you've developed over the course of your life as a touring musician, educator, and activist. So beginning with that journey, I wanted to know more about your first memories of feeling the beauty and the power of music. Like, what are some of those early memories where you're like, ah, this is something powerful that I want to engage with?
Yeah, I'd say the first memories were definitely in the Sikh community, in the context of devotional music. So in a Sikh Gurdwara, which is a house of worship, the primary mode of sort of like collective worship or a collective prayer is music. We call it kirtan or Gurbani kirtan. So you walk into a Gurdwara and the main thing that's happening for like 80% of the time is musicians singing, playing tabla, playing harmonium, sometimes playing stringed instruments, and singing these beautiful, what we call shabads or sort of devotional songs or hymns. And so that was probably one of my first exposures to, certainly my first exposure to live music, and also my first exposure to making music myself before I ever picked up the trumpet or learned music in school. I went to these Sikh camps when I was really young, where the Gyaniji, the sort of the guy who did kirtan at the Gurdwara, taught us the basics. And the instruments that we learned the basics on at that point were harmonium, which is like a pump organ that you sit on the floor and play, which is actually incidentally a colonial instrument. It's not what kirtan was originally played on hundreds of years ago, but has very much been adopted by South Asians across the subcontinent and is sort of synonymous with a lot of South Asian folk musics. And tabla, which are sort of hand drums, two drums there's a low side and a high side. So I learned both of those when I was a kid in a very simple way and got pretty into it. And, you know, I don't know exactly what it was, you know, because I don't think I really grasped the meaning of the shoveds, the devotional songs at that point. But I always, my mom tells me stories about being like really little, like a year old, and sitting in Gurdwara and just being sort of like transfixed and just like flailing my hands on my knees, like attempting to play along with the tabla player. So I think rhythm, I was always drawn to rhythm, but certainly also melody. I think with all the sort of like gender socialization and stereotypes, there wasn't many like young boys that wanted to sing and play harmonium. They all just wanted to play tabla. But I was also really drawn to singing and playing harmonium. Yeah, and so my kirtan teachers were pretty excited that a boy was interested in singing. So I wasn't trained in any formal way. It was like a very sort of grassroots community kind of education model. These largely weren't professional musicians who were teaching us, but it was enough to sort of lay a foundation and to pique my interest.
Mm. So you talked about singing, and I was curious about when the trumpet came into your life.
So I started playing trumpet at 9 years old, fifth grade, and it was really arbitrary. Unfortunately, I don't have a great story. It's, you know, a lot of kids at my public elementary school in Charlotte, North Carolina, either joined band, orchestra, or choir in fifth grade, and I decided on band. My brother did band when, you know, I have an older brother. He played the clarinet, so doing band seemed like, you know, a thing to do. And I remember trying to decide on the instrument. I first picked saxophone because it looked shiny and interesting, I guess,
right.
to a 9 year old. And yeah. My teacher was like, maybe something else. She's like, your hands maybe are too small. I don't know. I think most 9 year olds probably have small hands, but maybe there was already like too many saxophone players. And so it was totally arbitrary. I was like, okay, how about trumpet? That was also shiny. And she's like, that sounds great. And so that was that. And, you know, I think it was a few years of just figuring out the basics and not necessarily having a deep connection to the instrument, and no musical precedent in my family, really. Neither of my parents ever played music. Trumpet is as you may be aware, it's not the most pleasant sounding instrument when someone is learning.
When getting started,
yeah,
right?
It's like, it, you know, piano, you can just like, you know, press a key and it makes a pleasant sound, or a guitar, right. You can like strum a chord and it makes a pleasant sound. Trumpet, you know, it takes like a few years to be able to make a pleasant sound out of that instrument. So I used to practice in the bathroom, you know, much to my, you know, it's like my parents didn't discourage me, but they certainly didn't encourage me either. I think by the time I got to high school, I almost quit in middle school because I didn't like my band director. It's amazing how much like who your teacher is has an impact on you. So I almost quit band in middle school. We had just moved cross country to Phoenix, Arizona, and it was a hard year for a number of reasons, including just being like a turban wearing sick in Phoenix, Arizona, transplanted from somewhere else, and I had a southern accent and people were very confused by me. So thankfully I didn't quit, and by the time I got to high school, trumpet started becoming like a really important mode of expression, and also just like processing my own emotions and processing my way through the world, channeling my breath through that piece of brass.
Tell me more about that piece, like the channeling and the processing of your emotions through that instrument. And how was it different from singing?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I never thought of myself as a singer. And at that point, I was primarily singing kirtan occasionally, you know. Like in middle school, I definitely was still, and even in high school a little bit too. But it wasn't like a normal part of my life. It wasn't like a day-to-day thing. It was like an occasional thing when I was in a sick context. So I think I kind of compartmentalized it. Like that wasn't music. That was just its own thing. That was a part of being sick. And trumpet was something totally different. It didn't involve singing. It involved reading sheet music. But I think in subtle ways at that point, it was very important for, you know, my just coping with the traumas of being, you know, a sick young man who is experiencing pretty daily racist bullying and harassment. I think having a place to channel my emotions that was positive was super critical. I think most, I mean, I think this goes for a lot of people of color who were raised in the suburbs or raised in environments where there was just a lot of harassment against us, where we really stuck out. And certainly for other Sikh boys, I think a lot of us either went straight to anger and got into a lot of fights, or were really passive and withdrawn. And I was in the latter camp. Mm. I think for young people, it's pretty rare to have a more nuanced approach to coping with and challenging racism that we're experiencing. And for me, you know, the message I got was ignore it, just move on, work hard, and ignore it. You know, that was the message that I got from my parents. And obviously that's not sufficient.
Right.
And so, you know, I think I took it out on myself in a lot of ways. And I'm just grateful that I kept playing trumpet, because I think in subconscious ways that was super, super helpful for me to just deal with all the feelings.
It's interesting because, you know, I picked up the violin at an early age and tortured my parents with learning the violin. Played that for many years. Also did, you know, sort of European classical voice. Was into Broadway, you know, singing, you know, stage singing. And those were forms of enjoyment for me, which I think is important. But they weren't forms of expression or release of the racism, sexism, and homophobia that I was experiencing growing up. Yeah. I needed a different tool.
Yeah.
And for me, it wasn't until I found punk rock to express specifically that rage and find a release and get connected with that, that I was able to really release and express in that way.
Yeah.
And I know that you too have connected with other musical languages, ska, reggae, funk, punk rock, bhangra. How did those shift your ability to express what you were going through?
Yeah, I mean, I think both as a listener and a musician, immensely so. You know, I think in high school, I didn't really start dabbling in writing music and doing my own thing outside the context of institutional setting until like my senior year of high school, or like right after I graduated, because junior year into senior year, this is late 90s, I got turned on to ska just by some friends in school, and it just like immediately resonated. Just the joy of it and the rhythm of it and the dance, and just hearing brass utilized in a different way from how I was utilizing it, you know, because at that point I was basically playing either Western classical or marching band, you know, like at football games. And that was pretty much how I knew how to play the trumpet. There was always a sheet of music in front of me, and I played what was there, and there was still room for expression, and I did resonate with me, and I think it was important for me at the time. But once I started going off the page and off the cuff, you know, the world started like creeping open a little, like the door to other things. And that started from going to ska shows. There used to be a weekly ska night at a club, an all ages club in Tempe, Arizona, Moon Stomp Wednesdays, it was called. And so my friends and I used to go every single week. And so the first thing I did when I got to college in Tucson, Arizona, was find people to start a ska band. I was just like, I was like, this is it. Like, I have to do this. Like, I have to play this music. And so I think that was, yeah, I mean, the band wasn't very good. It was called Turban Jones. It was like a tongue in cheek, you know, like a lot of 90s ska had a lot of irony and silliness in it. But there was also ways that we, you know, the band was almost, I think, 5 out of 6 or 6 out of 7, depending on the time of us, were always folks of color, mostly children of immigrants. There was one other South Asian in the band. There were a couple of Latinos in the band. There was a Chinese American in the band. And so we just, you know, like as young people, wrote these like silly lyrics that just like had a way of processing our identities and the stuff we were going through, sometimes in direct ways, sometimes in really silly ways, where we'd write a nonsensical song that was like half in English, half in Hindi, and the Hindi was really bad. But it was just like our way of kind of owning our identities in ways that I don't think any of us really were in high school, where we were more feeling ashamed of who we were.
Right.
And so that, you know, college can play that role for, I think, a lot of second gen children of immigrants. And it certainly did for me. And, you know, gigging every weekend, which is pretty much what I did throughout college, was just super important for my development. And, you know, I was basically the front person of the band, the lead singer, a few of us sang. And I think that also was immensely important for my sense of self. And, you know, my sense of like being able to be front and center, like, you know, wearing my turban and being racialized in the ways that I am, and coming from a childhood of really like being inward about how I coped with all the racism, than to sort of like be in the spotlight in that way, I think it was uncomfortable for me, but it ultimately was super important for my sense of growth and my sense of positive racial identity development. Mm. If we want to get into social psychology.
Yeah. 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 I mean, I think it's like a important step on our social justice journeys, is starting by loving and accepting and embracing ourselves and,
yes,
you know, our whole identities. It's such an important place. Where did that place take you in terms of social justice activism? Mm-hmm. How did that launch you into the next phase of your social justice work?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it really began with popular education and facilitation. That's sort of how I was politicized, by being a part of some experiences of sort of like facilitated dialogue about racism, sexism, homophobia, and the like when I was a teenager. And so after that, I was like, oh, I need to do this now. So I got deep into sort of peer facilitation late in high school, and then certainly throughout college, I was facilitating anti-racism workshops in dorms and workshops with men around acquaintance rape and sexual assault and sexism. And that continues to be like a really core part of what I do in the world. At the time, I didn't know that could be something one could do in a so-called professional capacity. And then simultaneously, my politics was developing through what was going on in the world, and also what I was learning in it through like learning about Latin American history in classes I was taking. I was a sociology and Latin American studies major, and just learning the way that US imperialism works. I got really activated. I wasn't in Seattle in 99, but I'm very much a child of that generation.
Yeah,
like that is the politics that I came of age in and through. And so my kind of worldview was deeply inspired by the, you know, global justice or anti-globalization movement, really challenging the power of corporations and, you know, collusion with, you know, European and US governments to continue on patterns of colonialism in the modern age, as well as movements like the Zapatistas, right? Like that was and is a way of being, sort of like creating the world that we want to live in. That really resonated with me as well. So my critique of capitalism kind of developed, and I started seeing that to do anti-racism work and anti-sexism work in a meaningful way, that also means critiquing and challenging capitalism, right? Because these systems are so intertwined.
Absolutely.
And so I got really involved in the Students Against Sweatshops chapter at my university, and, you know, was doing direct action for the first time. And then by the end of college, then 9/11 happens, and then everything kind of, you know, like at that point I already had a fairly developed political self and saw myself as a radical, as someone who wants to get to the root of social problems and believes in some pretty fundamental change in our society. But then 9/11 was also sort of like a full circle of like reliving so much of the childhood racist trauma, because the direct experience and confrontation with racism became, I mean, it never went away in college pre 9/11 in the 90s, but it wasn't necessarily in my face 24 hours a day, which is obviously what happened after 9/11. And so got deeply involved in the anti-war movement, was coming to New York a lot and DC a lot for a lot of the mass mobilizations in the early 2000s. And then started a band when I moved to New York in 2003 that was a little bit more in your face about our politics. It was called Outer National. And we were very much born out of the anti-war movement, and tried to make a lot of those connections and call people to action through our music. And actually, that's that I learned Dole because of that band, because we wrote a song that sort of called for it. And I was like, yeah, maybe I can get my hands on a Dole. And that's how I started playing Dole.
And so is that the trajectory that landed you into Red Barat?
Totally, totally. And basically right after I left that band is when Red Barat started coming together.
Okay.
Like first with playing weddings mostly. I had met Sunny Jane, the leader and Dole player of Red Barat, some years earlier, just meeting musicians after coming to New York. We had collaborated in another project together as well. So I was one of the first people he hit up when he had this idea of a all brass and drums, Punjabi inspired band. And yeah, I thought it was going to be, you know, after I left Outer National, like we had signed a deal with Warner Brothers Records, and it was really the first time in my life I was a full-time musician. It was never really my intention. I was on a path to be a full-time organizer, popular educator and the like. And then I left all the day job stuff for that band. Tom Morello produced our first record. And then when I left that band, I was like, okay, music's going to be for the weekends. Like, let's get back into the real work. So-called real work of organizing. Cause I just felt really burned by the whole experience. And so Red Barat started as like, okay, I would take some vacation days to go out on tour. Mm-hmm. Cause that band took off pretty quickly. And, you know, after a year or two, it became pretty clear that I wasn't going to be able to hold down a job. And that felt like a choice that I was very willing and ready to make. And that band really felt like, you know, the politics are not as in your face with that band, but there's a sense of revolutionary joy in that music.
Sure.
And it became clear to me how actually important that was. I didn't realize how important it was, I think, when the band started.
Mm.
But through touring, through kind of like seeing and hearing feedback from audience, I was like, oh, this is actually a very good use of my time in terms of the kind of world that I want to be building.
Yeah. I love that the phrase revolutionary joy, because it's something that I try to fold into my music as an important aspect of social justice. And I feel it very much connected to my ancestral roots of Bomba, Puerto Riqueña, as like this reclamation of joy and connection to humanity in the face of inhumanity.
Yeah.
In the work that you're doing today, in the project that you're doing today, particularly with this album, Charikala, I was thinking about the concept, and you speak about revolutionary eternal optimism as the meaning of Charikala. Well, let me say that first, it makes me think about another concept that I've been exploring, which is infinite hope, and thinking a lot about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s quote, "We must accept finite disappointment, but never lose infinite hope."
Yeah.
And it's something that I've been exploring in talks that I give as it relates to music and social change. I was curious about this concept of revolutionary eternal optimism, and if you could explore with us more about what that means and how your new album embodies this concept.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Dr. King quote encapsulates it quite well, actually. I think sometimes it gets oversimplified as meaning like, oh, you're just always positive and always happy, right? And I think that's a very surface level understanding of Charikala. So Charikala literally kind of means ever-rising spirits, ever-rising sense of being. And so there's this idea in the Sikh community that's been around for hundreds of years of no matter how hard times are, no matter how dark the days are, we have this obligation to stay up, right? To hold our heads up high. Again, that doesn't mean ignoring pain. It doesn't mean ignoring suffering. But it's that, if we've lost hope, there's no reason to live, right? There's no reason to fight another day if we don't believe things can be better, right? And so this is a spiritual obligation for us as Sikhs, but it's also a political obligation for us as human beings. It's an obligation to ourself and each other and the divine. And in the Sikh community and in Sikh philosophy, that there's no division, there's no separation between the spiritual and the political, right? To fight for justice, to fight for liberation of all people is an act of worship. And so the only way we can do that is through embodying Charikala. It's an infectious spirit in our community, right? it's kind of like being the change we want to see. Like, we have to really embody it. And it's not always easy, right? And it's certainly not always easy for me. And that's precisely why I called the album that. And the idea for the album came about in times where I was feeling really dark, you know, with a couple of years into Trump's presidency, with, you know, Bolsonaro being elected, with Modi being prime minister of India, with Netanyahu's increasing popularity in Israel, you know, this global wave of sort of far-right authoritarians being elected, right? Trying to make sense of that is extremely overwhelming, I think, for any of us who believe in justice and liberation. And I found myself revisiting a lot of the Shabbats, a lot of the devotional songs I learned when I was a kid. My partner had just moved to LA for grad school, so I was spending a lot more time by myself in Brooklyn in my apartment, and have a harmonium, and started noodling around on the harmonium and like singing these Shabbats that I learned when I was a kid, and eventually started just making those, you know, those a cappella grid videos. Like,
yeah,
doing multiple tracks of playing multiple things in a very lo-fi way. So I eventually just started recording some of them, little 1 minute clips of me playing harmonium, playing tabla, playing dol, playing some percussion, and then singing three or four tracks of layers and harmonies. And just started sharing them with context about what the, and like digging into what these words actually mean too, and seeing how relevant they are to our times, and kind of understanding that this is not the first time, right? Like what we're seeing in the world is not necessarily new, but it's reverberations of a lot of the abuses of power that we've been seeing for centuries. And my ancestors were trying to make sense of it through this poetry that we consider sacred now, you know, hundreds of years ago. And so that's kind of what gave birth to the record eventually. You know, it took about a year for the idea of making it into a record. And there were these 1 minute clips on Instagram for a number of months that I kept recording, and eventually started writing my own music to some of these words that were written hundreds of years ago. And yeah, and I think throughout, the hope is to sort of get that spirit of Chardikala across to folks. Yeah. So there's like an introspection piece of it, but also a hopefully a call to action piece of it, because I think ultimately that's what Chardikala is about, right? It's about being in the head space, heart space, soul space you need to be in, and we need to be in collectively, to then act, right? To act in ethical ways, to act in revolutionary ways, to act in radical ways, to bring the world that we know should exist into existence.
Right. You have had a beautiful, full, rich story of your life in music and social change. What are perhaps three important teachings that you've learned in your craft and your career that you would want to share?
I think I do have some reflections. I think one, it sounds a little cliche, but to be true to yourself and your own heart. I think a lot of artists, aspiring artists in this age, including some that are extremely successful, are trying to jump on the latest trend. Like, the goal is the likes and the streams. And so we need to find that hot trap beat that is so in right now. And that really works for some, when that also, it really resonates with their own voice and their, like, who they really are and what they really want to say. I think the music that is the most inspiring and the most beautiful is really like a window into someone's heart and soul, right? And not necessarily just as an individual, but maybe even into your collective community or friend group or family's heart and soul. So I feel like, you know, whatever it takes to access that and channel it. And it's not always easy. And it's not always easy to know, you know, what is following a trend versus following your heart. But I feel like that's been an important part of my journey, to not worry about marketability, not worry about how is this going to be labeled, what genre is this going to be, and instead just like follow the music, follow what's coming from you and your collaborators' hearts. And that was very much the approach that my producer Will Dog and I took when making Chardikala. And you know, it's not necessarily leading to immense commercial success, but I'm really proud of the album, and I'm really glad we did it that way. And again, it does make certain things harder for people like us that don't care to sing in English that much and don't care about genres very much so. You can label it as 100 different genres, and then of course they'll just call it world music, and then you're like, what the hell is that? I would love to see more of that happening, right? Like, of less trend following and more just like bearing of souls. And you know, of course, like hundreds of thousands of musicians around the world have been doing just that in their own ways in every different genre for as long as human beings have existed. And that's what it's about, you know, that's what it's about. And another thing that I feel like has been really important, an important lesson for me, is collaboration and finding your people. And sometimes finding your people means noticing and realizing when you're not working with your people, you know, like when you don't have the right collaborators. And I think my band Outer National was an example of that, that there was a lot of beautiful things that came out of that. But ultimately, it was like a square peg in a round hole, right? Because from day one, I knew that there was some pretty serious political disagreements that I just hoped wouldn't, you know, but sometimes those things are much more serious about like who we are as human beings than we realize. So I think finding the right collaborators is just so, so important. And I think a lot of what that means is like, whenever possible, putting the collective over the individual. And I mean, I think that's something that is just important in all aspects of work, not just artistic or musical work. But I think as musicians, as artists, there's like so many models that exist out there that are very egocentric. And, you know, it's like about becoming a star. And you know, again, back to like how many followers you have and all this cult of personality that gets created around individuals. Somehow I have much less of an issue with it when it's around a project or a collective. But this like cult of personality around an individual, I think, is something that is a little bit toxic, or certainly can be toxic, and sometimes self-defeating when we get so fixated on it. So I think collaboration, collectivity is such a beautiful thing. Like, your musical ideas are always going to be better when in conversation with other people's musical ideas and political ideas and lyrical ideas, right? And so, you know, and this is me as someone who kind of reluctantly put out an album using my own name as the artist, right? Like, that was a long and hard process for me with the politics that I have. Like, I felt very uncomfortable with it for a long time. And ultimately, that was the right decision, because that is what it was. Like, that is how the project came about, right? Every single song was something that I wrote or arranged. So that is what it is. It's not, it wasn't like an end-all be-all going solo for me. But calling it solo is also such a misnomer, because there was 26 people that recorded on that album. There was a deep collaboration with the producer, Will Dog Abers. So collectivity was still an immensely important part of it. And now we go on to stages to play this music live, and usually as a five-piece band, and every single band member is bringing their own musical voice to it, bringing their own interpretation and recreating the music. And so that's something that I'm very committed to foregrounding, even as a so-called solo artist. And then that, I guess that's two. And then three, maybe I'll say, and this is like sort of the pragmatic bummer part, which is that, you know, capitalism really sucks, and it's really fucking hard. Am I allowed to curse? It's really fucking hard to make a living as a musician in 2022. It's like extremely difficult, like maybe more difficult than it's ever been to make a living as a musician. And that includes for me, as somebody that's been doing this so-called professionally for like 18 years or something like that. If I didn't have another way to make income, you know, I would be in poverty. Like, and so that's not to say like, don't pursue it as a profession. Absolutely pursue it as a profession. Something just being on the weekends, it's not enough time. But also like I think the pandemic just like changed everything in a lot of ways. And for me, I felt so, 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 so lucky that I had another sort of set of skills that complements my musical skills that I was able to use to pay the bills. And that's being a facilitator and popular educator. I facilitate a lot of workshops, and sometimes that pays better than music does. And so I was lucky to be able to just, it's not that I played less music, I made an album during the pandemic, but it's just music became less of my income, like in terms of the balance of what it was. Like pre-pandemic, music was probably 75% of my income, and you know, facilitation work was 25%, and then during the pandemic that probably flipped completely, or maybe went to 90% not music and 10% music, and now it's kind of like maybe evening out, back out.
Yeah.
So I think like developing a wide array of skills is really important, and that can be in music too, for sure. You know, production, engineering.
So you can definitely be expansive in what it means to be an artist. And I also love this idea that art doesn't have to be your income.
Yes.
You know, like we can create and be free of the confines of all the difficulties that come with blending your art with capitalism, right? Blending your art with the industry. You know, there's something, for me as a musician, I love doing music that is related to my profession, quite simply because it gives me more time to focus on doing what I love to make an income.
Yeah.
But I also do other types of music, explore other types of music that are not related to making money at all, and other forms of creativity that are just about creating, punto, and not, you know, related to making, being connected to money. And that's really important.
It is. And capitalism sucks. It's like almost the same conversation as, you know, like nonprofit workers, right? It's like the revolution's not going to be funded. Like we're not going to be radically transforming our, you know, the world through a 9-to-5 nonprofit job because of the way that funding works. And in a way, it's like the same lesson can be applied to music. It's not to say we shouldn't do that. We need people doing that, just like we need people making their livings off of music. But it also creates so many restrictions upon us. And I look forward to a day where that's not the way things work, and artists are just guaranteed income and can really do what we want to do and don't have to think about our next paycheck in the ways that we do now.
Right. Right. Well, here's to continuing to shift our world.
Yes.
Through our art, through our creative minds, so that we can land at that place where we can be our whole beautiful selves without compromise.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this wisdom with us. I encourage everyone to take a listen to the new album. It is beautiful, and I'm really grateful for your work.
Thank you so much. Likewise.
Thank you so much for listening to The Rhythm of Rebellion. I want to thank our guests today, as well as Moses Nagel, our editor, Sina Basila Hickey, and all of our partners at Hudson Mohawk Magazine. You can find me on Facebook at Taina Asili Music, on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and YouTube at Taina Asili, and at TainaAsili.com. Peace, love, and liberation.